Thank you for listening. This is Derek Jensen of Resistance Radio for the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Kathleen Berry, who has been working for decades and doing incredibly important work on opposing female sexual slavery. And she's the author of the book Female Sexual Slavery and also The Prostitution of Sexuality. And she has a more recent book called Unmaking War, Remaking Men, How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. And her work has been so important to me, and I think is so important to the world, that what I would like to do is talk today about her most recent book, and then we'll schedule another interview in the future to talk about the work that has made up the bulk of her career. So first, thank you for being on the show. I'm so happy to have you.
Thank you for inviting me, and I'm very pleased to be here.
Thank you. So the first question is, how did you come to write this new book?
You know, I really did not have this book in mind at all until I was watching the news coverage in 2006 of the Israeli invasion and bombing of Lebanon. And now, I've been watching the news, as we all had, the news coverage of the U.S. invasion and bombing of Iraq since 2003, but when Americans are killing human beings in war, they don't refer to innocent lives being taken. But as the reports of the Israeli bombing went on, the death toll increased every day, and the reports kept referring to the loss of innocent lives. And, you know, we've all heard this term. I've heard this term for decades, and I've not thought twice about it. It's even encoded in international law as an understanding of how to go about war appropriately in terms of protecting innocent lives. But something really rubbed me the wrong way about it. So I started pacing up and down, and then eventually I went to my desk and took out a clean pad of paper, and I started writing. And I discover a lot when I'm writing, and I finally realized that what was bothering me so much about the term is that as soon as you say that innocent lives should not be taken, and you say who the innocent lives are, civilians, women, children, seniors first of all, that kind of thing, as soon as you say that, you've automatically said that there's other lives that can be taken. And I went, whoa, I better write an article about this. And I couldn't get to the end of an article. That's happened to me when I wrote Female Sexual Slavery, which also started as an article. It was so big of an issue in the acceptance of war and killing, but the acceptance of men being a designated group who are going to go and kill and be willing to be killed is something that has just not been explored. We've just passed it by and let this term innocent lives prevail in our lives as if some human beings' lives are more valuable than other human beings' lives. And we know in reality in our society that is not true. Women's lives are not more valuable than men's lives in our society. If they were, we would have equality. We would not have violence against women and all those kinds of things. So there's a crazy-making kind of perverted logic around all of this that as a feminist, when you stumble on something like that, you know that you've got another one of those enigmas that you have to, you know, untwist and straighten out and really, you know, get to clarity on. So that's where I got started.
That was a direction I wanted to go with this, but you just brought that up something else. Can you name a couple more of those enigmas that you've had to unravel?
Well, female sexual slavery was one of them. I was asked to write an article on trafficking in women back in the 1970s, because I seem to be the only person I've been working on violence against women, and I had been collecting a file of newspaper articles on trafficking. One of those things that back then I could, oh my God, I don't believe this. You think you've reached the pits of violence against women and the worst things that could happen, and now I'm discovering this. So I started writing about it. I pulled out this very thin file with a few articles. I started doing research and really getting into the research. And I realized, first of all, the same thing that I realized when I started Unmaking War, Remaking Men. I have to go to some of these places where this is happening. So when I was writing Unmaking War, Remaking Men, I went to Lebanon, I went to Israel, I went to different places where, you know, wars were, I got to Lebanon just after the bombing stopped in 2006, so it was still pretty raw, the bridges were still being rebuilt. At any rate, with female sexual slavery, I wasn't calling it that. I was just writing an article about trafficking in women, which was obviously prostitution. Oh, my heavens. Nobody's ever talked about prostitution and trafficking in women in the same breath. Why is that? Well, I guess that's something that I have to explore. And then I came up against all these kind of myths about there's no research, there's no discussions. Again, this is the 1970s, about how women get into prostitution, or how men come to be buying human beings to use for sex. But there's all these myths about how women get into prostitution. And basically they're summed up, you could sum them up as they fall into it. You know, like you're walking down the street, they trip, and then they're in prostitution. It was that zany kind of perverted logic again. And so I ended up, you know, an article became a book, and the book became, you know, a part of a lifelong campaign. As I was writing the book, I kept saying to myself, that's it, I'm publishing this, and then I'm done with this subject, and, you know, here we are decades later, and I'm still dealing with it. But fortunately, now there's consciousness of it. So I wanted to point out something else about Unmaking War, Remaking Men when I started writing it. And that is, you know, you brought this up when we were talking before the interview in terms of what got me involved with this. And I realized that there's a collective consciousness around certain issues that are real violations to human life. And that came up to me very poignantly, very painfully and prominently when I was on the beach at the Pacific Ocean. I live in Northern California, and I occasionally go to Bodega Bay in the ocean north of there, and was walking along the beach, and there was a helicopter on the beach, and a friend I was with said, oh, somebody must have drowned. And they, you know, in complete denial, said, oh, no, that's not possible, until we saw them bring a body bag out of the helicopter and start carrying it up it's not a hill, it's more like a cliff, but there's stairs up it. And that was the first thing that stunned me. But the thing that immediately overwhelmed me was the people at the beach and how everybody was crying or, you know, in a state of shock. Nobody was in the water. It was just people were starting to pack. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, and people were packing up their picnic things to go home. And when I started writing Unmaking War, Remaking Men, I came back to that scene and realized that where we agree that a death should not happen, such as happened to this man in his early 30s who was trying to save his son, and his son was saved, and he was caught in the riptide and died, and his body was sent out to sea. And when we see something like that, particularly if it's a we, like all the people on the beach that day, we're caught up in not only our personal reaction to it, but a kind of collective grief in response to, you know, a life that shouldn't have been taken. And it seemed to me that that would function, that story would be really important as kind of the moral base for my book, Unmaking War, Remaking Men, because I'm not really reaching into religious beliefs. I'm not reaching into moralistic piety of any kind. I'm just reaching into the value of human lives to us as human beings and how war is possible if we have that value of human life. And I think that that experience at the beach that I had and conveyed in this book is a really good example of how implicit that value of human life is for all of us. I didn't know anybody other than my friend at the beach, but everybody was caught up in it. And everybody was, you know, just got up and kind of walked away. And so that ended up for me establishing a kind of foundation for the book, because we're so used to accepting death in war. We hear reports of it every night on the news. And we're so used to accepting it. And we've in fact normalized it by saying that some lives should not be taken. We'll call them innocent lives. And then there's other lives that can be taken, and they also can take other people's lives. And we call them heroes. Heroes who sacrifice themselves. Just listen to any news clip that has anything to do with Congress or a presidential statement that involves the military, and you'll hear heroic sacrifice of our soldiers. No, it's we who sacrifice them. And then they take as many lives as they can to prevent their own lives from being taken and their buddies' lives from being taken. That's all they do. That's what they're there for. So I got ahead of my subject, but I get really passionate about this when I start talking about it.
So how does that happen, that this fundamental relationship of empathy toward another being who, and the reverence for the other being whose life has just been taken, how does that get turned over? What is that process by which that empathy is either removed or set aside or destroyed or subsumed somehow? So what is that process?
Okay, there's a couple of ways to answer your question. One, and I've already alluded to this, is the way that the society normalizes it. So we talk about innocent lives, and then the rest of us, including myself until 2006, forget that means that there's other lives that can be taken. And we just don't think about that, because the way the society normalizes it, that's all there's to be said about it. The Geneva Conventions have said that, and they don't use the term innocent lives, but they have said that there are lives to be protected during war. And by doing that, they've bifurcated the Convention on Human Rights by basically saying, if you're in combat, you have no human rights. They're gone when you're in combat. You go to a combat zone, you're geared up for combat, your human rights have been suspended for that period of time. So you do anything is done to you, it can be done. that violates human rights, because that's what combat is, isn't it? After all, it's fighting and shooting and killing each other, and bombing each other, and bombing without even having pilots in the planes to bomb, in terms of the drone bombing, and so there's a normalization of that in just the very way we think and talk about war. It's in our language, it's in our morality, it's in our basic assumption about human beings. That's one part of the answer. The other part of the answer is that I want to attribute a lot of cleverness and a very perverted kind of brilliance to the U.S. military, because they know how to take that and turn that into a training for soldiers. And so the focus of basic training or training for the Marine Corps, the primary objective that has to be achieved is in making soldiers out of men and now some women, is the destruction of human empathy so that they can kill without remorse. When you kill without remorse, you're a sociopath or you're a psychopath. Our worst criminals are the ones who kill without remorse. These shootings that we see in TV coverage and hear about in the news every few days or every few months, and these trials of serial killers, serial rapists, they are without remorse. To be without remorse is to be without empathy. That is the goal of military training. That is not my my particular kind of interpretation of it. That is what they do. You have to be able to man up and be able to kill without having any second thoughts about it. Any second thoughts about it, and you might be dead. Or you, even worse, your buddy might be dead. And so the military not only makes you responsible as a soldier going in to combat for clearing out your empathy, but it makes you responsible for the life and protection of your buddies. And your buddies are responsible for you, and you're all responsible for each other. So they built this really very clever, in the most devious, perverted sense of the term, clever kind of network that holds soldiers in place while they're murdering other people. And this is soldiers of any nation, but I'm particularly concerned about the American military, and I know a lot more about the explicitness of the way they train this way. Then we go back and normalize what they're doing by calling it heroic and a sacrifice. And we get the generals who did all the killing before they started getting promoted up the line, being thanked by Congress for their service to our country. They get medals, they get awards, they wear all their medals when they go to Congress. And they are supposed to be our heroes. That's the way we normalize what they do. What they do in combat, the killing that they do, the absence of empathy, the destruction of empathy in these human beings who are going to go into combat, is what these generals are responsible for. And so we come back to it, you know, the president will tell you how heroic these soldiers are. He'll have them standing around him when he goes to a base, and any president, Obama, Bush, or, you know, any one of them will do this, so that we won't think about what they're really doing, so that we won't think about how they got to be that way, I go into quite a bit of deep detail in Unmaking War, Remaking Men about how the military does this and how you can look at any cult that does brainwashing and see that the military has adapted the same strategy for basic training and or for, you know, the training before going into combat.
So you said the phrase man up earlier, and so what's the relationship between everything you're saying here about that process and masculinity?
Oh, a very important question, and that's really the core of my book. You know, I'm a sociologist and psychologist, and feminists and you know, various leftists and human rights activists have been very focused on breaking down masculinity to masculinities and femininities, because we don't like that word, but into, you know, various ways of being a woman, various ways of being a man. All that's probably true. Much of it is probably true and correct. But what we have ignored is before males and females, but I'm going to talk about men for a minute, before males learn how they're different from each other and how diverse they are among the group of men in the world, they learn what I called in this book a core masculinity. And that is the masculinity by which they learn that their lives are expendable. Their lives are expendable because they can be sacrificed in war. Their lives are expendable because they're supposed to protect us, women, who they find inferior. So it's a real load for men. They're told to understand that we're inferior to you, not you specifically, but that we're inferior to men, and those same men also learn that they have to protect us. That's worse than a double message. And so what we see then is in socialization, very early, infant socialization and early childhood socialization, we see boy babies and children learning to tough it out. And there's studies that have been done that parents will pick up a baby girl who's crying more quickly than they'll pick up the baby boy who's crying. Because, well, the girl should be soothed and coddled and the boy should tough it out. Not consciously. No, this is not done with any particular consciousness. Again, it's so implicit in our society. And so what many males do, have to do, males who just will not fit that mold of core masculinity, they have to throw it off explicitly. I'm sure that we could go to any sampling of men who consider themselves to be supporters of women, of women's rights, of feminism, to be allies of women, to be not violent, and to not be that kind of typical macho man. And we would find in the background of most of them that there are moments that they can remember when they've had to turn away from the expectation that they act in a particular way, and possibly had to suffer for it, particularly in school from peers, for being a sissy, or what's the word for it now, a wuss, or whatever the words change from time to time. And so that core masculinity is something that either turns into macho men, or men who turn into macho when something provokes violence from them, but don't live as macho. You know, they're not the pornography consumers and the ones who are harassing women on the streets and stuff like that. or there are men who have turned away from that. But as I said, they've had to pay a price for it.
Yeah, I'm thinking about what you said about a moment when they turn away. And, you know, in my own life, I don't know how much of my work you've read, but I've written about how my father's extremely violent,
mm-hmm.
and there was a lot of abuse in the childhood family. And I remember when I was, 6 or 7 or 8, seeing some advertisement on TV about how whatever percentage of adults who abused their children were themselves abused.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking in that moment, this is not something I can ever inflict upon someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't that one moment changed my life. I think that was the moment I articulated the movement the direction that I was, you know, I was not going to go to that.
Right.
Follow that training as best I could.
Yes, you've portrayed that very sensitively. What was the title of that article again?
That was probably in the Language Older Than Words where I wrote about that.
Ah, okay. I just want to make sure we got it out there.
Thanks.
Because it's really important that people know that men write about these things in this kind of way, and that men have consciousness about this. We're hearing so much from men. There's all these debates going on these days. Well, I guess they've been going on since forever, whether men should be called feminists, for example. And I, you know, I don't think I could be called a black power person. I could be called a white supporter of it. What's missing in these kinds of discussions are the men who've really stepped up and laid out what's wrong with all of this and done it from their own experience, because that's ultimately the convincing argument. And I had to go way beyond my own experience in writing this book and really try to get inside what the experience of someone going into combat would be.
So one of the things that I keep, and this, you know, one of the things that I really love about writing is that, and reading really good work, is that you can come across something and all of a sudden it's something you never thought of before. And it's like, oh yeah, of course, that makes sense. And that's one of the things that your writing does for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're saying essentially that in order to make soldiers, the military has to turn people into sociopaths.
Yes.
And so that leads to a question that, especially in this country, I have to ask, but how are you going to have war if you don't have a bunch of sociopaths?
That's the point. Exactly the point. That's the question, and it's the answer. You are not going to have war if you don't have a bunch of sociopaths. But I'd like to just come back to the way you phrased the question and rest for a moment on that phrase of how the military turns men into sociopaths, which I write about in this book. There's a lot that's being said about PTSD. Lately, and the military is starting to acknowledge that PTSD is a problem for soldiers. Although a recent report from the military said that they found that it didn't have to do with combat. It had to do with alcoholism and drugs and things like that. Which is, I mean, it's so easy to see through them. I can't believe they say such stupid things right out to the media, and then the media parrots it as if it could possibly be the reality. Why are they drinking? Why are they taking drugs? Because just like, you know, anybody who's doing something that violates their own being, they have to wipe it out of their mind. So they're out there killing, they come back and they do what? Just sit around and talk? They do pat each other on the shoulders. The sergeants and the upper-ranking guys there come in and tell them how proud they are of them, you know, for the killing that they do. But, yeah, of course they're coming back and drinking. If there's drugs available, of course they're taking it. Taking them, because what you do when you've done something that violates your, not just a code of conduct, it violates your soul. I'm not a religious person, but I know that there's more to us than our material being. And and soldiers say that, by the way. Every soldier whose testimony I heard or who I interviewed, when they talked about being in combat and killing another human being or other human beings, every one of them have referred to it as a loss of soul. I don't think they even say that to each other, unless they're veterans against the war, you know, back home meeting, trying to piece their lives together and have some consciousness what's wrong with war. But I think that's how they explain it to themselves, that something broke inside of them. And it's more than just a clinical psychological diagnosis. It's something of one's very humanity that is broken. But that starts not in combat. That doesn't start in combat. That sociopathic behavior that you were talking about starts in military training. When you take an average human being, because we all get empathy as part of the package. You know, we get to breathe, we get to think, we get to do certain things. We get empathy comes as part of our package because we're interacting human beings, and so empathy is a very important form of human interaction. So to wipe out something that is part of who we are, or to try to wipe it out, to the extent that, you know, the soldiers can go off and kill, they can joke about it, they can laugh about it, and play games over it. In order to do that, to wipe that empathy out in basic training, you have already begun to create the basis for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, in a soldier. So the military is starting it in basic training, and then it continues and actually becomes a full-blown force when they kill. I give the story of one soldier, and I won't go into detail about it here because we don't have the time, but one soldier and how important it was for him to become part of the group when he arrived in a combat zone as a kind of newbie. You know, that's what they called the guys who haven't killed yet. They're newbies. And nobody talks to them. And then when he kills, he's in. He's part of the group. Doesn't this sound very similar to what happens with these religious brainwashing cults? You know?
It does. And it also reminds me of, I used to teach at a maximum security prison, and a lot of the gangs have a rule of blood in, blood out, that you actually can't become a member of the gang until you kill someone.
Well, yeah.
I'm thinking something else here, though, too, which is, okay, let's fully recognize the whole Robert J. Lifton claims to virtue thing, that before you can commit any atrocity, you have to have yourself convinced that what you're doing is actually good. So, you know, the U.S. military is fully rationalized that they're, you know, spreading democracy and freedom or whatever it is they're spreading.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Nazis were purifying the Aryan race, they weren't actually committing genocide against the Jews in their own perspective.
Right.
You know, no matter, and this culture is not killing the planet, it's developing natural resources, whatever. We can,
yes,
we can rationalize anything we want. But so given that, that people will rationalize things and rationalize almost everything, one of the jokes I used to tell in a lot of my talks is I have never in my life been a jerk, you know? Every time I've ever actually sort of objectively been a jerk, I've had it fully rationalized that I'm actually doing some sort of good thing, but the truth is I'm being a jerk.
That's excellent.
And so we do it, you know, we do it all the time. So setting that aside, what do you do about, I mean, you started with you know, with Israelis and Arabs. I mean, what do you do when someone wants what you've got, or when someone, what, you know, there's the question I asked a moment ago about, but if you don't create sociopaths, how are you going to have a war? And, you know, that's central to all this. But then what about legitimate self-defense? I mean, where does that fit into this whole rubric? And once again, recognizing that, you know, there should not be a United States Department of Defense because the United States has only been attacked once in 1941, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That invading Iraq was not actually defending.
Right.
So with that truth, what do we do with all those truths? And where do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yes. Yeah, and I'm going to be very, I was going to say banal, but I won't be that hard on myself. I'm going to be very kind of ordinary in this and say that we really need to get into the high schools, the junior high schools. There's programs going on in the elementary schools for teaching children empathy, which shouldn't even have to be taught. I mean, you can see how far away we're getting from it, that it's being taught, but it's being very successful. As I was writing my book, I had in mind teenage boys and young men as well as adults. I think I've always found that one can write to multiple audiences because what you really owe your reader is clarity, and if you're clear, then, you know, a teenage boy can read it as well as the book is being used in college courses and that kind of thing. And I'm not saying this to promote my book. I'm saying that it's the consciousness that I'm talking about in there. When I get to go into a classroom and talk to like 150 students in a college classroom last year on this subject, and the young men in the class really came forward and went, "What? We didn't know any of this." Tell me all about masculinity. And they're going, "But we didn't know any of this." And it provoked incredible discussion, which, in my view, really turned into consciousness raising. And I was a guest there, and the professor whose course it was sent me an email afterwards saying the discussion went on for several classes after that we really need to get in to this very place that we started this conversation, the stuff that we take for granted. You know, using the term innocent lives as if it's okay for the other lives to be taken. We need all of those presumptions to come up and be challenged in a way that, for example, there, except for the diehard racists, and there's a lot of them in this country, but there's not as many of them as there were in the 1960s when I was in the civil rights movement. And we made certain language, certain behaviors impossible for lots of people to do. And so there's a different kind of portrayal of African-American persons, both men and women, in the media now. It's still not where we want it to be, but we've made huge changes there. By contrast, violent masculinity is and has always been a number one entertainer in our society. We made no headroads at all. Zero. And so I think that the changes have to be that basic. I'd like to be able to sound more revolutionary about that because I want to see a real change in this society. But I would really like to see us getting to young people so that that young people stop enlisting. They stop believing this idea that they're going to be able to get a college education by going into the military. And or they're going to get the $30,000 that's posted in front of military recruitment offices and really get the facts in front of them and really get the veterans. There's a large number of veterans who are very opposed to the military and to combat. Getting them into the classrooms and talking to students. I think I'm being very repetitive and I don't want to take up all of our time on this, but am I getting to the answer to part of your question?
Yeah, I think you're getting to part of the answer and a very important part. And I guess what and yes, I think it's really, really important what you're saying. And I guess what I'm also trying to get at is what I hear you saying is that one of the most important things we can do is attempt to reinforce, I was going to say instill, but that's the wrong word because empathy is already there,
mm-hmm.
to reinforce the empathy that is inherent in us as either human beings or as beings.
Yes.
And so you're talking about the importance of reinforcing that, which would help to reduce the influence that militarism holds over our lives. And that's, the last phrase is not so good, but...
I think your point is really fantastic and really just, it's so much on the mark, I want to emphasize it. That we undo what the military is doing by really emphasizing empathy. Where they're trying to... diminish it or destroy it in human beings, we really call for it. We really insist on it. We really put that challenge up to young people who are even thinking about going into the military.
And the problem is not, from my perspective at least, is not just the military, but it's the larger, I mean, when you talk about empathy, one of my hobby horses is just how much I can't stand Richard Dawkins' work. And it's just, I mean, the whole selfish gene theory is the same normalization of sociopathy and a lack of empathy that we're talking about. So my point is just there's, you know, so many different, it's like, okay, I kind of hate to use this word, but it's kind of a sort of fractal thing where, you know, you can see this larger superstructure of patriarchy that destroys empathy as manifested in militarism, in the selfish gene theory, in all sorts of other, in misogyny, you know, all sorts of other ways.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we have like two or three or four minutes left, and
can I take this one step further?
Great.
I talk about critical empathy in the book, which is really wedding political consciousness to empathy. And it's something we feminists learned back in the 60s and early 70s in our consciousness-raising groups. And consciousness was first and foremost empathy with each other. And that was a violation of patriarchy. Because women are supposed to be against each other, not bonding with each other. I think that consciousness raising with an emphasis on empathy will produce exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about and that we've been talking about. It will produce a new consciousness in the society. I have a program and that's on my website that I offer when there's groups, enough people together who want to do this group, which is exactly that. St- starting out with really connecting to what empathy is, building up the political consciousness that keeps us from it, and going into strategy sessions for how to take that into the world, into action. And it's exactly what we were doing in the 60s and 70s. It's exactly what brought about the whole women's liberation movement and, you know, and a lot of it has died back, but I'm, you know, many of us are working on, you know, trying to bring that forward. But I really want to see men involved with this, because that's where it's going to spread, between and among men, in terms of redefining masculinity. So I guess the reason I wanted to jump in on this is to say that engaging in empathy is a big step toward engaging in a new political consciousness. And you need to then develop what that political consciousness is, which is what we've been talking about for the last hour and what my book is about.
Yeah, I love what you just said, and I think what I would like to do is I want to make one comment, and then if you want to respond to that, oh, also, before we do that, can you give your website?
Oh, yeah, it's www.unmakingwar.net, or my name, KathleenBerry.net.
Okay, so, thank you. And so the last comment I would like to make, and if you want to respond to it really quickly, is everything you're just saying now reminds me of my friend Charlotte Watson, who used to run the Battered Women's Program for the state of New York, the Domestic mm-hmm. Violence Prevention Program. And she's a wonderful, wonderful activist. And one of the things she does is she's completely relentless. She asks basically every man she sees, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? Mm-hmm. You get in a taxi cab with this woman, she'll say, can you take us to Central Park? And by the way, what's it going to take for men to stop beating on women? You know, don't get on the subway with this woman. She's just, she's relentless. It's wonderful. And her answer is that women can't do it by themselves. And what it will take, that women can't stop men beating on women by themselves. But what it will take is other men. And one of the things it takes is peer pressure. The example she gives is it will take a man saying to another man, I'm not going to play basketball with you anymore because I heard you call your girlfriend a bitch. And
yep.
That sort of peer pressure is radically transformative, according to her. And I'm just, can you give a quick response to that, and then we'll...
Yeah, I think it is radically transformative, but I think it's, I think it's a wonderful action to do, what she's doing, because for many of the men she brings it up to, it's going to invoke more questioning and more change. But I think you got to get into the issues a little bit more deeply. You got to get into the, how do you put yourself in the place of that woman who has just been called that name, and figure out what it's like for her to walk away and go on to the next thing. How do you put yourself in the place of that, you know, Iraqi who has just seen his wife raped by an American soldier? How do you put yourself, and then what do you do with what you know from putting yourself in the place of that person? Then you've got the basis for empathy in action. And so I think, you know, in the short cab ride to Central Park, she's done as much as she can. And some of them will go on and take that next step and look at the empathy, and or they'll just think about it and be, you know, more aware. But we want to build this into a driving political consciousness. I'm so glad this came up. I was actually thinking this morning, how can I get the word out about needing to do groups of consciousness raising on empathy with men to get them moving on this? And it's like, you know, my wish is your command or something like that.
Well, thank you so much. I think everything you're saying is so important. I'm so glad you've been here.
You are a wonderful interviewer, and this is one of the best interviews I've had, especially with a man. I mean, you're so thoughtful and caring about this issue. I really appreciate it very much, Derek.
Oh, thank you so much. And This has been Kathleen Berry with Derek Jensen on Resistance Radio for the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you very much for listening.